Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. You're tuned in to Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Hey, do me a favor. If you're an iTunes listener, make sure you rate Beyond the Darkness. Give them 5 stars and tell us how fantastic we are. Every time you guys rate it and get that number up there, it gives us more exposure on iTunes, and we could use the help, especially in October. It's always great to get a lot more exposure during this month so we can continue to grow our burgeoning army of darkness. So please go check it out for yourselves. If you are an iTunes listener and rate the show, give us the 5 stars we need, want, and beg for, and just give us a nice little dissertation if you don't mind too much. And if you are a Droid user, did you know that we have a Darkness Radio app? So you can actually download the app for free. I know. Why don't we have one for iTunes? We've been working on it, and we just keep having troubles with iTunes getting these things put through. But our Droid app is up, and we're going to be updating it very soon here. So you can go download it. It's free. It'll give you access to all of our shows, all of the ways to contact us, all the cool news and things that we're going to be involved in. So go check that out. It's Darkness Radio. That's the app name. You can download it. It's got our skull. You'll be able to find us and have that on all of your Droid devices to take with you. And please, pass the word. This is October. This is our month to grow. We need your help. Let everybody else know about the best in paranormal talk radio. We'd appreciate your support and love on that. And since I'm speaking about support, make sure to support our advertisers. And the one way that you can do that, if you're using any of the advertisers you hear on our show, send us an email, a testimonial about your experience working with those companies. We may incorporate them into a future episode during one of our commercials. So please support our advertisers, because when you support them, that helps to keep this show free 5 days a week and gives you great access to all of our archives and very limited commercial breaks. So support our advertisers that support us and be a part of the show. And our last little mention here, we are still doing our Second Harvest Heartland Halloween for Hunger campaign. We need your help. We are really, really trying to get up to this $15,000 goal to beat last year's goal when we hit $13,800. And I know with your help, we can get there. $15,000 is going to help us supply 45,000 meals to people, individuals, and families in need right here in the United States. Second Harvest Heartland is one of the biggest, strongest, and best food shelf programs in the United States. But they need your help. They need your caring. And right now, more than ever, with all the tragedy and things that are going on in our country, they need your help. So if you could step up and make a donation, no donation is too small. Even if it's just $1, that will feed one person 3 square meals for a day. So please, really consider doing it for us. Go on to darknessradio.com and click on the Second Harvest Heartland Halloween for Hunger banner, and it'll take you right in to make the direct donation. If you're having trouble finding the banner, just email me, dave@darknessradio.com, and I will send you the link. All right, let's get started with tonight's show. I'm excited to have him back with us. Kevin Randall is a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel who served as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam and an intelligence officer in Iraq. He studied anthropology and journalism at the University of Iowa and holds advanced degrees from the American Military University and California Coast University. He's been studying UFOs for 50 years and has published dozens of books on the subject. His new book is out. Encounter in the Desert, the case for alien contact at Socorro. Welcome back to the show, Kevin. It's been a while. I'm glad you're here with us tonight.
I object to you telling them I have been studying UFOs for 50 years.
Well, I'm reading it straight from your bio. So
I'm just saying I object to it because it makes me sound so damned old.
Well, no, it just means that you're seasoned and really good at what you did from a very early age. We'll look at it that way.
Okay. I started before I was even born, by the way. So
yeah, obviously.
A paranormal link there.
Obviously. Your mom was channeling and automatic writing all of the books right from the womb, right?
Absolutely. Sounds Excellent. Good to me. I'll buy that.
Kevin, for people that aren't familiar with you and your work, why this fascination and interest in unidentified flying objects?
Well, you brought my mother into it, so I'll run with that.
Okay.
The reason I say that is I always blame my mother for the interest because when I was a kid, she took me to the movie Earth versus the Flying Saucers. She had an interest in science fiction. Science fiction is about alien visitation. It's about visiting other planets and other civilizations and that sort of thing. And the step to UFOs isn't that large because it's about alien visitation and alien civilizations and visiting other planets. So I always say that kind of sparked my interest. But I do remember going to that movie Earth versus the Flying Saucers when I was I must have been 7 years old, 7 or 8 years old. I'm not sure why she took me, but she did.
And That imagination spark, I mean, that's what's driven so many of us that love the paranormal, the supernatural, UFOs, Bigfoot, psychic phenomena, monsters, myths, and legends. It drives us because of things that we were exposed to at early ages like that. But you had a unique experience being part of the military. Was there ever any encounters, and especially we hear a lot about UFO encounters during wartime, were you ever witness or eyewitness to any of these situations or know people that were?
No to the first part of your question, and I just say no because it's true. However, during my military career, because of my interest in UFOs, and a lot of people knew about it, it was no big secret, I did see things coming down through channels that dealt with UFOs. There was something that was called the Weekly Intelligence Brief, and it gave situations around the world that would be of importance to air crews flying into other countries and things like that. And periodically, there would be a UFO sighting in there, and so I was exposed to it that way. Nothing spectacular, nothing really great that came down through that. And what I find now in today's environment is looking back at the records that had been collected in the past, and I think primarily Project Blue Book, but other things that we've learned about, I'm able to interpret some of these things much better than civilians who have had no military experience. And the best example is Philip Klass, in describing the history of Clifford Stone, said that he had been a detective sergeant in the Army. And I realized that what it had said in the record, and I have a copy of the records as well, it said debt sergeant. Debt mean detachment sergeant. Had nothing to do with being a detective. And Phil Klass just misinterpreted that, not realizing that that was the abbreviation for detachment. So, I mean, those sorts of things helped, I guess, understand some of the sightings that were made by or the information that was transpired or transmitted by military systems. So that has always helped me in that respect. But the simple answer to the question is no, I've never really seen anything in my duties as a military officer, and I was never exposed to anything officially as a military officer, which is probably not the thing to say in today's environment. I should be making up great stories about all the inside information I have.
You said that there would be some military briefings about UFOs. How would they refer to them? What was the terminology that they would use? And were they matter of fact about it, or were these reports pointing out the suspicious nature or the possible dangers of encountering these things? How would they be broken down?
These were just sighting reports by air crews or other individuals assigned to military installations around the world. Nothing ever very spectacular. It was straightforward. This is what the crew reported. And if the crew reported that it did S turns and circled the craft and all that sort of thing, that would be reported. It would say, well, this just seems ridiculous that it would be circling the aircraft. And it was just straight facts. Not a lot of information. Maybe the aircraft commander or the senior person on the ground who had made the observation would be mentioned. But for the most part, it was just a straightforward account as kind of a, here's an interesting little tidbit type of thing. Nothing really spectacular.
Well, if it was there and readily available for people to see, was there any scuttlebutt? I mean, were you guys talking about it on site, or was this something that was better seen and not spoken about?
I never ran into that. And here's the best example of that. When I was commissioned into the Air Force, because all officers have to have a security clearance, and I was asked to take a slot as an intelligence officer, which required a top secret investigation. So I think the FBI did it. So there was an investigation of my background. And at that time, I'd written a whole bunch of articles in magazines. Back in the mid-1970s, there were six or seven magazines, national magazines, publishing UFO stuff. So they needed lots of material, and I was sending as much as I possibly could do it. Made a good living doing that, by the way. But they all knew about it. When I got to Richards Bauer Air Force Base, and I was being shown around the facilities, and was taken to lunch by one of the senior officers, and he knew about my interest in UFOs, and I'm not sure how he knew that. And he said, I was reading this interesting story, and he would give me some of the details. He says, yeah, I wrote that one. And I think that happened like twice. He was telling me stories, and I had written the article that he was talking about. But the real point is, when they went to the background investigation for the top secret clearance, the guy who was conducting the investigation actually lived across the street from my father. And so we knew what was going on there, and they had like six or seven of the articles I had written in the file, and they were all critical of the Air Force, and yet I was going for an Air Force top secret security clearance, and there was never any problem with it. Is the whole point of that. There was no problem in getting the security clearance, even though they knew of my interest in UFOs and what I had said about the Air Force investigation of it.
And did they ever try to dissuade you from continuing on? And curiously, do you believe that maybe when that commanding officer was telling you that, was he not just telling you as, oh, by the way, I read this, was he trying to let you know, hey, we're on to what you're doing and what you're writing about. I just want you to know this is not going unnoticed.
If I was smart, I would tell you absolutely, a great conspiracy. Unfortunately, the truth of the matter is, no, nobody really cared. Two things spring to mind is when I went into the National Guard right after 9/11 and we were about to deploy into Iraq, the battalion commander said to me privately, he says, since you're now on active duty, maybe you should leave your rank off your books. And I think he was thinking mostly some of the science fiction I'd done, but suggested because of since I was on active duty, having the rank on the book would be probably not be right. And now I kind of wish I'd done that earlier because the rank is so much higher than it was on the books. But and it was just so that I didn't get into trouble with the regulations about using my rank in something outside the military forum that hasn't been properly vetted. So he's just trying to save me some aggravation. There was really nothing bad about it or anything like that. So that came to mind. But also, while we were in Iraq, we had the first sergeant of the headquarters company was a big fan of NASCAR. And he said something to me one day about the UFOs, being the UFO guy. And I said, how do you like being known as the NASCAR guy? And he said, yeah, I see what you mean. You filter her down into one kind of characteristic. And of course, my interest is much broader than just UFOs, and his, of course, was much broader than NASCAR, and we were in Iraq, for crying out loud, when we had a lot of other things that were impacting our attention.
And I get that. And here you've got this unique situation in your life that you are part of the military. Were you kind of surprised after hearing about all the conspiracies and the way things were shut down at Roswell that everybody just seemed pretty easygoing about your fascination and interest and writing about it?
I think if you look at the situation, Roswell's 1947. They don't have a clue to what's going on. They're stymied. They are presented with a problem they don't know how to solve. And I cover that in the book that I'd done not too long ago, Roswell in the 21st Century, which kind of takes another look at the Roswell case in a dispassionate light to see if we can kind of filter some of that stuff out. But that was that long ago. And by the time we get to me being in the Air Force and that sort of thing, Blue Book is closed. The Air Force is denying everything. You have a UFO report, you call the Air Force base. They said, we don't do that anymore. Call your sheriff if you're fearing for your life or something. So that didn't come into play at all. The only thing that happened was when they were investigating the Roswell case in 1994-95, Lieutenant McAndrew used to call me, and he was the guy working with Richard Weaver, who was the Colonel Richard Weaver on the Roswell project for the Secretary of Air Force. He would call me periodically and try to get me to admit that I was just in it for the money, and you can admit that. It's okay. We understand that. And I think what he was trying to do is if he could get one of us to flip, and by one of us, I mean like Stan Friedman or Don Berliner or Don Schmidt or me to flip on the case, that would be quite a coup for the Air Force. And of course, none of us ever flipped that way. But once I moved into the National Guard and back into the Army, it was never really an issue at all. There's no issue about that at all. So, I didn't see any attempts to suppress the information. When we deployed to Iraq, I had the additional duty as a public affairs officer, and got into a bit of a dust up with the local Iowa National Guard public affairs officer who was kind of annoyed that the newspaper articles I was doing for the local newspapers as the PAO would sometimes, you know, give my name, Captain Randall. And I looked up the regulation, and given that mission, that was appropriate. I could say captain. And that, and nobody would really care. And he sent me a really nasty letter, so I quoted the regulations back to him and what it was. But the battalion commander got involved in it. And he wanted me, I'd showed him my responses, and he said, well, you need to tone that down a little bit. You're being a little bit combative. And then he said, you know, I never got a letter from this guy. Can you show me the email you got? And I didn't. And he immediately emailed my response to the guy, because my response was, I'm not technically a member of the Iowa National Guard anymore. I'm a member of the active duty U.S. Army deployed to Iraq. So, you know, I don't care what you say. And so finally they came down and they said, well, it's okay if you send out these stories as long as you clear them with the brigade public affairs officer. And I went up to talk to her and found out she was a lieutenant, and I outranked her. And I said, screw it. I don't need her approval for anything. So I just continued to march the way I was. But, I mean, the point was there was really no conspiracy to
there was no hush file, right? There was nobody trying to shut you down.
No, not at all. Not at all. There were people worried about the regulations being obeyed properly, which, you know, I'm on board with that. Using the rank in the newspaper articles was fine according to regulations, because I was doing it as the public affairs officer for the battalion. So that was fine. The best one was where I was identified as a war correspondent. I said, that's going to be great on my resume when I get out of this place. But there was nobody really cared that I was doing UFO stuff. People would ask me about it. In fact, in Iraq, because of satellite TV, our enlisted guys in the what we call the Soldier's Palace, where a bunch of them lived, we were on the Baghdad International Airport, which we always called the Bush International Airport just to annoy the Democrats. But Hussein had built this wonderful resort area, and we were kind of in that area. And the Soldier's Palace was this huge building with air conditioning and all this stuff, and they had a satellite TV into it. And a couple of the NCOs came up to me one day and said, do you have a brother? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we saw a guy on TV with the same last name as you and talking about UFOs. I said, yeah, that was me like 15 years ago talking about UFOs, because they were getting the History Channel. I knew the History Channel was running some of the documentaries I'd been in. So that's the extent of the queries about me being involved with UFOs.
All right. We're back. Kevin Randall, my guest this evening. And as I said, the book is out and available. As a matter of fact, it just came out, what was it, on the 23rd. Is that right, Kevin?
Officially launched on the 23rd, but you know as well as I do that it was available on Amazon and in some of the bookstores before the 23rd.
Only if you had special double secret clearance in order to get it. I have that as good authority. That's exactly how it went down.
Well, and that double secret clearance authority as if you had the internet and could click on Amazon.
Shh, Kevin, make yourself sound like it's a much harder reason or a much harder way to get your book.
This book is so good that they're trying to suppress it, and you'll be lucky to find it, and you better hurry to Amazon to get it now.
That's right. Go to darknessradio.com, click on the Killer Deals link to order your copy. All right, let's get started talking about this Encounter in the Desert, the case for alien contact at Socorro. Now, this takes us back through the annals of time as well, back to, what, 1964?
April 24th, 1964.
All right, set up the scenario and the history for us. What was that area like? Where was it? And how did this story unfold?
I have no clue. No, I'm just kidding here.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us tonight, Kevin.
Good night, everyone. No, the thing is, I do my own – I host a radio show, and I'm always – afraid you ask a question and the guest is going to say something like that. You know?
Oh, I've had that happen. After 12 years, we've had it all.
I don't know what's going on there. No, seriously, the idea, the book is about the Lonnie Zamora sighting in Socorro, New Mexico. Socorro is a small town between Albuquerque and Alamogordo on Interstate 25 now. It was, I think, Highway 85 back in 1964. And he was chasing a speeder through Socorro and heard a noise, a detonation, an explosion, a roar, and thought a dynamite shack that was on the edge of town might have exploded. So he broke off chasing the speeder and went up there and saw this craft. Eventually, he got up to the point where he could see a craft on the ground, tried to approach closer to it, saw two beings outside the craft. They suddenly spotted him. They disappeared around the craft. There was a bang, like they shut a hatch, that sort of thing. There was another roar. The thing took off and disappeared into the distance. He got a good look at it. An egg-shaped craft type thing with landing gear underneath it. That's it in a nutshell. Basically, a landing of a UFO with the occupant seen by a police officer. For the longest time, I, like most other people, would say, well, you know, it's a single witness sighting. Even though he's a police officer and his reputation is fine and he'd have no motivation to make up this story for any reason whatsoever. And those who'd seen him not long after this, and when I say not long after the sighting, I'm talking within minutes of the thing disappearing, realized he had been frightened badly by this experience. But you say, well, it's a single witness case. And I was doing my radio show, and I had as guests Ben Moss and Tony Angiola, who had been doing a reinvestigation of the Socorro case for a couple of years. And they said, you know, there were three other witnesses who called the police that day. And I said, did you get the police records? And I asked them the question three times and never got a satisfactory answer. And they said a couple of other things during the show that kind of sparked my interest. And so I started looking into it, and that's how the book came about. But I started looking into it. One of the first things I found in the Project Blue Book files was a report written by Captain Richard Holder. He was the upper-range commander at White Sands Missile Range. His duty station at White Sands is basically south of Alamogordo, but Socorro is way north, and the missile range is so large. His duty station was actually closer to Socorro than it was Alamogordo, so he lived in Socorro. But he was involved within an hour of the sighting, he and an FBI agent named Burns. He did a report that very night. And in that report, he mentioned that three people had called the police station having seen either the flame in the sky or the object in the sky prior to Lonnie Zamora seeing it on the ground. Documentation within minutes of this whole thing going down. He wrote the report that night before he went home. So the documentation exists. Now, here's what gets me, and I tried to trace this down, and I couldn't get very far. They've now got the sighting of the craft. They've got the sighting of the beings. They're told three people called the police station. Nobody ever looked for them. The path the object took was known. Socorro wasn't that big in 1964. You could have knocked on doors and probably found those people if you really, really attempted to do so. But the important point is they called the police station and the police reported it to this Air Force, or this Army officer who recorded in his official report. There was a gas station operator named Opal Grinder who owned, I think it's Whiting Brothers gas station there in Socorro on the US 85, and a car had pulled into the gas station. The driver said to Grinder, "Boy, you guys fly your aircraft pretty low around here," and said one that almost, something almost hit us, the car. Grinder never got much information from the guy. He took all the car, the driver, his wife, the three boys in the car, they all took off. They thought the car might have come from Colorado, but he wasn't sure. They never found those people either. Now, here's what's interesting about this. This sighting was national news within, I would say, hours of the sighting. It's on the news. Walter Cronkite is talking about it on the news. And I remember a neighbor, I lived in Aurora, Colorado at the time, a neighbor telling me about this sighting, and he'd seen it on the news, and I watched the next day and saw it. It was in all the newspapers and that sort of thing. Those people never came forward. And I don't know why. The people in Socorro, they all knew about it. I think part of the problem is the people in Socorro knew how Lonnie Zamora had been treated by the media and some of those who came to ask questions, and he was more than a little annoyed about it. The other police officers wouldn't really talk to anybody about it either. So I had to go back through the documentation that was available to document all of this sort of thing. So when you say, I say there were three additional witnesses, I can't tell you the names. I can just point you to the documents that exist that tell us those people were real. And I think that's an important thing. So now we no longer have a case of just single witness, and although he's a police officer, we have additional witnesses to it. It's just unfortunate nobody talked to him. Jerry Clark, in his UFO encyclopedia, I keep throwing these names out so that you have to link more stuff on your Amazon thing there. That was a little humor, I guess.
I'm with you. Nope, I'm with you.
I was going to say, take a look at the movie Beyond the Time Barrier. See if you can find that on Amazon. Well, anyway, that's a really obscure movie.
I'm jotting that down, as I always do, in my Beyond the Time Barrier. All right.
It's a really cruddy movie.
Oh, excellent.
Really bad 1960s science fiction. Anyway, Jerry Clark in his UFO encyclopedia actually has the names of a couple of other people who were involved or saw something that very evening as well that kind of ties into the Zamora sighting. So no longer is a single witness. We have unnamed witnesses who are reported by the military, and we have named witnesses that Jerry Clark has talked about who saw something within a couple of hours after the Zamora sighting took place. There was another sighting up in La Madre, New Mexico, I think is up close to Santa Fe, if I remember the geography correctly at the moment, with a craft on the ground. Didn't see any creatures outside of it or anything like that, but a craft on the ground took off, left burn marks on the ground and a melted soda bottle and that sort of thing as it took off. So it was another very good sighting that took place, I think, the day after the Zamora sighting. So there was a good string of sightings throughout New Mexico at the time.
You've got this area that seems to be pretty rich in UFO sightings. And as a former military, I don't know if you're retired from that. So doesn't it seem that there would be a lot more chases? Because, I mean, we're still seeing and hearing quite a bit in New Mexico regarding current UFO sightings. Why are they not scrambling jets, especially in this post 9/11 atmosphere? Why aren't we seeing more of these fighter pilots chasing down these unidentified craft over our airspace?
I would say if we were 20 or 30 years ago, regulations prohibited the release of information of a UFO sighting that was unidentified. The Air Force regulations spelled it out. If there was a plausible explanation for the sighting, you are free to release that to the public. If you cannot identify it, the information is immediately somewhat classified, and you're not able to release it. I don't know of any regulation that exists today that prohibits the release of information about UFOs. but we have had sightings in the recent past where jets have been scrambled to intercept UFOs. The Air Force mission requires it. If there is an intruder who penetrates the defense zones, they're required to scramble and identify that intruder. So there would be a flight scrambled. I think for the most part, and if I remember the chain of commands properly, most of the air defense missions are held by the Air Guard. They're the ones that who do the scrambling of the missions rather than the active forces. In the way the military is structured today, there's the active forces, the reserve forces, and the guard. And they've tried to mesh all three because you can spend a lot less money training reservists and guardsmen than active duty forces. And some of the missions that water purification, for example, that mission is almost universally a National Guard mission because, you know, you can get the training, you can do that stuff at a fraction of the cost that the active forces would cost you. So, you've got to look at all of those things. So I would think, based on that, that the scrambles would be Air Guard as opposed to active duty Air Forces, depending on the locations and what active forces may be available for those missions. That would be my guess. And I would think that there's just not a lot of talk about it amongst the pilots and the people who would be involved in those sorts of things, so it doesn't get out into the public arena.
We're going to delve more into this case, Encounter in the Desert, when we return. Remember, folks, besides doing all of the Beyond the Darkness episodes and True Crime Tuesday this week, I'm just going to keep forcing myself on you. I'll be hosting Coast to Coast AM Friday and Saturday night this week, the 27th and 28th. On the 27th, we want to hear your nightmares. As a matter of fact, we have a doctor who's going to help you interpret and understand your nightmares. Are all nightmares bad? And when you have a nightmare, what does that tell you about the life that you're leading? What about paranormal encounters during dreams? What could that mean? Is there some basis of truth to spirit communication? We'll find out from our guest on Friday night. Saturday night is an evening spent in a haunting atmosphere. We're going to have Troy Taylor and Colin Dickey with me for all 4 hours on the show. Troy Taylor in the first 2 hours, Colin Dickey in the last 2 hours, as we talk about American hauntings and some of the most famous and infamous hauntings around the United States. We've got a lot more coming your way. Stay tuned. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Remember, help us out. Go to your iTunes and rate us a 5-star and give us a great little review on there. That helps out and helps us get quite far on exposure for iTunes. And the more of you that respond, the more it gets pushed up in the numbers. And we'd love to get exposed, especially in the month of October. Help Tim and I expose ourselves. Would you please help us expose our... Wait, that sounds horribly bad. But anyway, go help us out if you're part of iTunes and rate and review us. We'd really appreciate that. All right. We are back tonight and talking with Kevin Randall. His new book just came out, Encounter in the Desert, The Case for Alien Contact at Socorro. Let's get back into this case. It's certainly a compelling case because, again, here you've got an officer, a police officer that witnessed. This isn't just some hunyuck that was coming out of a bar at closing time or hiding there still and saw this swamp gas come up. This is an officer of the law whose job it is to be a professional observer. And that really starts to make this an exciting aspect of the story. And then you have other people. Now, you said a little bit earlier that there are reports, but they weren't very specific in who these other people were that had come forward.
There's documentation about the reports and Holder's a report that he sent forward to the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And I've got the actual document printed in the book or the transcript of what he wrote in the book so that you can read exactly what he said. But there was descriptions of what the craft looked like in the sky, either a flame, which is also something that the Lonnie Zamora had reported, but also a hit of a craft. And so there were three people who called the police about that. And if there were three people who called the police, you can assume that there were other people who'd seen it as well in the Socorro area. And then there were other sightings around New Mexico in that same time frame. A couple of them turned out to be hoaxes, and I look at all of that stuff in the book, and you know, this is a hoax. We can ignore that. But I also look at all the documentation that was created. Jim and Cora Lorenzen, who ran the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization in the 1960s up until their deaths in the 1980s, were there within 48 hours talking to Zamora. And Sergeant Moody, the Project Blue Book NCO, was there that same Sunday. So the landing takes place late on a Friday night. The Lorenzens are there on Sunday. Moody is there on Sunday. And there's a funny story that Jim Lorenzen told, that he was in the hallway and saw Moody, and Moody was talking to a couple of the police officers, and he says, oh yeah, that woman here, she's kind of a nut, you know, a UFO nut, not realizing that the woman is, of course, Jim Lorenzen's wife, Coral. He's talking about that, and then he's introduced to Moody, and Moody is kind of nonplussed about that whole thing. But so you had the Lorenzens there, you had Ray Stanford, who was the NICAP representative. I think he got there on the Tuesday, and he talked to Hynek, and Hynek got there around the same time frame. So you had J. Allen Hynek from the Air Force consultant on Project Blue Book there. You had NICAP there. You had APRO there. In the end, Hector Quintanilla, who was the chief of Project Blue Book in 1964, tried to find an explanation because he knew this was a case that is really going to get the UFO crowd hopping because it's a landing with alien creatures involved. And he tried very hard to find a solution and admitted not only in the Project Blue Book files, but admitted in the in his own personal memoir that he really wanted to solve this case, but he couldn't do it. He thought the explanation might be locked in Lonnie Zamora's mind, meaning there's some observation that he had made that for some reason he hadn't mentioned anybody, or something that he knew that would solve the case. But externally, beyond that, he could find no explanation for it. He had gone to Holloman Air Force Base, which kind of was running a lot of experimental type aircraft and that sort of thing, along with White Sands. Been there with top secret clearance, and you guys can tell me anything you want about what's going on. And he could find nothing to fit into the description of what Lonnie Zamora said. But as I say, you know, and that stuff also is in the book. The transcripts are in the book so that everybody can see it for themselves, and everything is heavily footnoted. So, you know, it's not me just telling you this story. It tells you where the information came from, and you can go to that source and see the information for yourself. And I tried to use mainly primary sources. One of the guys I talked to was maybe technically the last chief of Project Blue Book, a guy named Carmen Morano. And there's pictures of Quintanilla and the Blue Book staff, easy for me to say, in a number of magazines and that. And you can see Carmen Morano standing there next to the people. So, I mean, he's there. He saved a lot of documentation. It ended up in the hands of Rob Mercer, and Mercer was kind enough to share the Blue Book aspect of it with me, which is like 200 pages of material that matched quite a bit of what was in the Blue Book file, but there were some deviations that were interesting, an unofficial file as well. So there's a lot of documentation that I was able to get my hands on. So when we're looking at this stuff, we're looking at the reports that were made the night of the incident, the reports that were made within a week of the incident, the investigation carried out by the Air Force, the investigation carried out by Hynek, the investigation carried out by Ray Stanford. I talked to Ray Stanford a couple of times about what he had seen and what he had done on this side. And Sanford may be the only guy left alive who was actually on the scene in 1964. So I was able to talk to at least one of the guys who was there within hours of the landing. So we got all that kind of information brought up in the book. And I think it's the first time, I mean, everybody who is involved with UFOs knows this Coral case, knows this Coral landing, knows Lonnie Zamora's name. But when you look at how the case is presented in those write-ups, it's always a, you know, maybe a chapter in a book or a section in a book, but it misses some of the essence of the case, some of the important nuances. And I tried to get to those and provide the documentation so it's not me clouding the issue with my extraterrestrial bias or whatever. But here is the information as straightforward, as dispassionately as I can present it. And all of that is brought forward in the book as well.
When you see a case like this, are you surprised? I mean, especially when we hear of all the conspiracy theory to denounce UFO, to hide evidence. And here you're looking at something from 1964, and you're about to release this in 2017. And it seems like you were still able to find a very large portion of these reports, which starts to fly in the face of the whole idea that some dark shadow government agency is hiding the case of UFOs and alien encounters.
I think you have to look at it from two points of view. One of them is this case was national news. You couldn't hide it. The information was out within hours in the national media. Holder had told Zamora there was a symbol seen on the craft. And there's a whole chapter in the book about the symbol and what it really was. Holder tells Zamora not to tell the press about the symbol. His thinking was, and the Lorenzans agreed, the Lorenzans being civilian investigators, agreed that this would weed out the copycats. You know, say, well, I saw that craft too. What did the symbol look like? If they couldn't tell you, then clearly they weren't involved.
Right.
And Burns had said to Zamora, don't talk about the aliens, because he thought that would bring ridicule down on Zamora. So the conspiracy aspect I found in this case were two of the investigators, the governmental authorities, Captain Holder and FBI agent Burns, weren't trying to suppress information to keep it out of the public arena, but were, A, trying to help Zamora so he isn't ridiculed by the press. Well, the guy saw little green men. He didn't. He saw beings in white coveralls and that sort of thing. To withhold bits and pieces of the information merely to validate other claims. And there was another claim. There were two guys from Dubuque, Iowa, who claimed that they had been driving through Socorro on Friday night, April 24th, and had seen the craft in the sky. And if you go back and you look at their descriptions of what the craft was and that sort of thing, you realize they were making up the story. But their names surface in an awful lot of the reports about the Socorro case. I went to the newspaper office and got a copy of the article, which was really a dumb thing to do because I could have found it online if I'd looked. But I got a copy of the article and could see the problems. And they're talking about a melted pop bottle on the Zamora site. And I realized that, A, from where they were, their descriptions of where they were on the highways, they can't see the landing site, given the terrain, and B, the melted pop bottle comes from the La Madera sighting up near Santa Fe. That's a whole different sighting. They've obviously heard the story on the radio as they were, I assume, because they said they were driving back and they heard the story, part of the story on the radio. But they tell the story in Dubuque, I think, on Wednesday, the following Wednesday, about that. But they clearly had been influenced by everything else they heard. Did they see a craft in the sky? I don't think so, because they talked about a row of windows around the perimeter of the craft, and Zamora said nothing about windows. But I was able to talk to another guy named Rick Baca, who was 14 at the time, but his father was working in the city attorney's office, and Zamora had gone to the city attorney to talk to him to make sure that his job was safe and he wasn't going to get into any trouble, and described the craft and everything that he had seen to the city attorney and with Rick Baca's father sitting there. And then Baca, who is something of an artist, drew exactly what the craft looked like. And for those of you who'd like to see the drawing, A, it's in the book, but B, the April Bulletin on May of 1964 has Baca's drawing in there as well. It appeared in the newspaper, the Defensor Chieftain, which is the Socorro newspaper. So it's in there. The symbol that everybody talked about, Zamora saw the drawing, and Baca's father drew the symbol just as Zamora described it to him. But that is whited out in some of the pictures, or it wasn't on it when some of the pictures were made, and it's on it in other pictures. So you can see that sort of thing too. But there was an awful lot of that sort of thing going on. So Zamora told the story to the city attorney. We have good evidence that I talked to Rick Baca. There's a guy named Paul Harden in Socorro as well, who provided me with information about the sighting. One of the great things that goes on is Philip Klass talked about it being a hoax that the mayor had devised to because he owned the land where the landing supposedly took place, and he was going to create a motel, and all of this has come to see where the aliens had landed. And Paul Hardin had gone back and researched the tax records, found out that the mayor didn't own the land, and Klass was way off on that bet. But you see that recounted in a number of other books, you know, this bit of information that the mayor owned the land where the thing landed, and it turned out not to be true. And nobody had ever really talked about that until I was Hardin had published an article in the Defense or Chieftain about it that I happened to come across, and I talked to Paul Hardin about that and got the whole tale from him. So, you know, there's a lot of that kind of firsthand information in the book.
All right. Getting all of this information, going through it, and starting to sort fact from fiction, that's amazing, right? When you start seeing things that point you in the direction to maybe start putting a dent into this story because maybe there's an ulterior motive, and then you're actually able to prove that it was the false part of the story. That is what's so intriguing to me about a story like this.
And the other thing we have to point out, these are like 50 years ago, too, so we're going back half a century to gather this information.
Right.
And there were things that should have been done at the time that were not. And it just boggles my mind that nobody thought, well, if Zamora's talking or people had called the police station, let's see if we can find those people. Because that would make the case that much better. But nobody bothered to look at it. And I don't care who it was. The Lorenzans never found them. The Air Force never looked for them. NICAP never looked for him. Nobody ever looked for him. And I'm just, my mind is boggled by that sort of thing.
Well, to me, Kevin, if you could, real quickly. I mean, that was still during the Cold War, right? Was there a concern that this might be a Russian craft, a communist plot to overthrow our country? I mean, was that part of any of this research, or is that all just skirted over and ignored?
There is absolutely nothing to suggest that there was any Soviet component to it. Russian collusion.
Isn't that fascinating, though? Because you would think that there would have been such a fear at that time and possibility, and especially with what was going on in our country at that point in history, you would think that would make it really the foreground of what the investigation would have been.
Actually, Zamora didn't want to talk about it, and his friend Sam Chavez, who was a state policeman, a state police sergeant, believed that Zamora had seen a black project, that it was U.S. government, some kind of testing of a U.S. government project. Mm-hmm. And they believed that because I think that fit more into their worldview than the idea that it was some kind of an alien spacecraft. You know, but in all the looking at the documents, and had Quintanilla been able to find anything like that, that would have been the answer slapped on the case quickly and immediately, and he left it as unidentified, and he was very reluctant to do that. It's one of three cases, I think, of the Blue Book files that have alien creatures that are marked as unidentified. But this is by far the best of those cases. But the thought was not of Soviet, but of U.S., black project, and they had seen something like that had gotten off the White Sands missile range and landed briefly and then took off and went back to White Sands. But there was no evidence ever that explanation works.
I am fascinated by those aspects of these stories and how they look at these deals. Hold that thought for 1 second. I do want to mention, listen, it's October, folks. You're all looking for cool entertainment. You want the next scary thing. Of course, you've got shows popping up. But if you're looking for something that really marries history and mysteries extremely well and gives you a good fright and fills you with great information, much like our show, it's there to educate, enlighten, and entertain you. Well, titillating you and frightening you all at the same time, then check out Lore. It's a creepy 6-episode series that's exclusively available on Amazon Prime. It's inspired by the podcast phenomena created by Aaron Mankey. The podcast itself has over 70 million downloads. 70 million people can't be wrong. Go check it out for yourself with the brand new series. It's from an executive producer of The Walking Dead and one of the executive producers of The X-Files. Based on real historical accounts, the episodes use a unique mixed media blend of archival footage, animation, and reenactments, reminding us that the scariest stories are true. Check it out for yourself at Amazon.com/Lore, L-O-R-E. That's Amazon.com/lore. Watch now exclusively on Amazon Prime Video. And if you missed yesterday's doubleheader of True Crime Tuesday, shame on you. There's one available on Beyond the Darkness in our True Crime Tuesday Revisited. Was it possession or insanity? We talk with two people in the know about Mark David Chapman before the assassination of John Lennon. We find out about his background, his history, and the darkness that surrounded him. It's a fascinating aspect and story, one from one of our very first years on the air. I think you're going to really like that. That's our Beyond the Darkness True Crime Tuesday Revisited. And then our standard True Crime Tuesday show. I'm getting emails like crazy on this episode. If you're looking for a good jumping off point, folks, sign up now. You need to hear this episode. It is absolutely phenomenal and so unbelievable. This, again, I can't even begin to explain to you just how twisted this story is. And for those of you that enjoy true crime and real life stories, this is the one that I would say, if you're looking for a point to start off on True Crime Tuesday and subscribe, then you got to check this one out, because it is by far, I think, now one of my favorite episodes. Tears of the Silenced. Our very special guest star is Misty Griffin. She and her sister were held in captivity by her mother and stepfather until she was 18 years old, when she was dumped into an Amish community. She was one of the first people ever to be accepted into the Amish community, where she thought she was finally escaping a lifetime of hell, only to find out a whole new nightmare was unfolding for her life. You got to check that out. How do you subscribe? Just go to darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. It's $5 a month. That gives you 4 to 5, 90 to 120-minute episodes every month of the best in true crime talk radio. Go check that episode out. That was yesterday's episode. And we've got a great little deal going. Everybody that subscribes until November 22nd is automatically entered into a drawing. And on my birthday, we're going to do a drawing. Three lucky winners will get a one-year paid subscription to True Crime Tuesday. So go sign up now. There's no reason to hesitate, no reason to wait. True Crime Tuesday awaits you. And if you like the free tastes you've been getting every Tuesday this month, then go subscribe for the all new, brand new episodes. You're guaranteed brand new episodes every month. Plus, that $5 gets you access to all of the archives of the show for the past year as well. So you get a lot of bang for your buck, and you can cancel at any time. So go sign up at darknessradio.com, click on that True Crime Tuesday banner, and make us a part of your Tuesday and everyday listening between Beyond the Darkness and True Crime Tuesday. Kevin Randall, our guest this evening, as we're talking about his brand new book, which is out and available, Encounter in the Desert, The Case for Alien Contact at Socorro. Talk to me a little bit, if you would, Kevin, about the aliens themselves. What did the eyewitnesses say about these beings?
I will go into that in just a minute, but your discussion of the true crimes clicked something in my mind I'm very bad at promoting my own work, but I did a book called Conversations, which deals with past life histories, and this one clicks into the Jack the Ripper mystery as well. The subject is kind of reliving a life as Jack the Ripper and other historical serial killers. And it's kind of an interesting book that deals with it as sort of a historical aspect of it, looking at the history of it and that sort of thing. It's an interesting little book. It's called Conversations. It, too, is at Amazon that they can look up. And if somebody was to buy it and read it, please do a review, because I think it's a book that people would find exciting and interesting given the subject matter. But that kind of, you know, it clicked when you were talking about the true crime stuff.
And you just brought up a great point, not just for Kevin Randall, but all of our authors, but specifically for Kevin Randall. Go and rate and review his book, Encounter in the Desert, The Case for Alien Contact, or any of the books. When you go out there and you rate those books, it helps, again, expose these authors and give them their due. A lot of these authors are really putting their heart and soul into their work. And when you've got a fantastic author like Kevin Randall and such a great resource, make sure that you help him out. You love the book, go review and rate the books on Amazon.com. And we might just have to have you back for a True Crime Tuesday to talk about Conversations then.
I would think so.
All right. Sounds like a plan to me. Now let's talk aliens.
Yes, aliens. Well, Zamora didn't get a long look at them, But he got close to him. And I think if you look at some of the history that they talk about in other books, they suggest he didn't get very close to him. But it turns out he was within 30 or 40 feet of the creatures when he actually saw them, which is why they were somewhat surprised. He said they were about the size of 10, 12-year-old children. They weren't very, very large. They were humanoids. For a while, the story was he didn't see anything other than white coveralls sort of floating in the breeze. And this was kind of an outgrowth of what Burns had said to him, trying to cover up the idea he'd seen alien creatures. He didn't get a good look at them. He didn't see headgear on them. But he did actually see creatures as opposed to just white coveralls. They were in sight for 2 or 3 seconds, he said, and they were startled by his presence on the scene. They ran around behind the craft, and then moments later it took off with a roar, and he dove for the ground, covered his head thinking the thing was about to explode. So the creature aspect of it was interesting. There were footprints left around what might have been the place where a ladder or some kind of stairs into the craft had touched down as well. So there were some kind of footprints there. The aliens disappeared behind the craft, and he heard the bang of the thing like a hatch closing, and then it took off. So the description of the creatures, a humanoid, white coveralls, not very large. He thought that they were children. So, didn't look really strange, I guess. I'd love to be able to tell you that they, had glowing eyes or something like that, but there was really no description of that at all.
That is kind of strange in itself then, right? But I guess there's so many different races of these beings that are reported that maybe it's not that strange or difficult. And again, if they're going to try to be around our planet, I guess not looking too much like a sore thumb might behoove them to fit in a little better.
I don't know. I just, it's one of those things. I can find you scientific papers that would suggest that evolution on other planets would go in different directions and you wouldn't get humanoid type creatures. And I can find scientific papers that suggest that the best way of developing intelligence is basically the way we have it with the two arms, two legs, stereoscopic vision that helps develop the brain and that sort of thing. So you kind of pick one and run with it. I've always said that the dinosaurs were not killed by the asteroid, but they were hunted to extinction by other dinosaurs that had been able to develop hunting techniques and use weapons and kind of like our ancestors in the distant past, hunting all the dinosaurs to extinction. But we're just talking about Zamora's idea that he was looking at children. Didn't see anything strange about them or anything like that. Just two small individuals near the craft.
All right. Now, this is a pretty overwhelming amount of information. Again, this wasn't a light in the sky. This wasn't seen from 200 yards away. There's a lot of detail in this. Kevin, as a researcher yourself, And it sounds like, if I'm picking this up from time to time, you're very skeptical of some aspects of the story as well. When you're hearing the story on the upfront, does it sound too good to be true? Are you expecting this whole story to kind of fall apart as you dig a little deeper?
As I said, I got started when Ben Moss and Tony Angiola were telling me about what they had discovered, and they mentioned, for example, the three witnesses. I never heard that. And so I went into it to see what I could verify about that. So I went into this looking for the information. I try not to bring a preconceived notion to the investigation, but I mean, you move into an investigation like this, you're dealing with alien spacecraft, for crying out loud, and you can say that the best explanation doesn't involve the invention of interstellar flight. Something terrestrial is probably the explanation. But you don't rule out things simply because you find them implausible. If we did that, the coelacanth would still not be known.
Right.
Because this fish went extinct 70 million years ago. It can't possibly still be alive. It's the old prospector's, I guess, attitude, which is you don't expect to find the gold, but you always look because you'd be really dumb to walk over it. And I kind of go in with that idea, you know, I don't think I'm going to find a good solid UFO sighting, but I have to look. And the elements here seem to be there. I was fortunate to be able to have it at my disposal, the incomplete Project Blue Book file on the case, plus the information that Rob Mercer had found when Carmen Morano saved that file that was going to be destroyed. He thought this information should be, as they were cleaning out the Project Blue Book offices, closing down the operation, they were going to destroy this stuff. And he thought it should be saved. Since it wasn't classified, he took it home. And he was going to do something with it, never did. And Mercer found it by accident on Craigslist. And the story's told in the book as well, how Mercer came across this stuff. But he said he would go to Craigslist looking for UFO stuff because sometimes it pops up there. And some guy had bought a bunch of lumber at a garage sale, and as he was cleaning out the lumber, this box of material was behind it. And so the guy put it on Craigslist, and Rob Mercer bought it. And so then Mercer went back to find the house, learned who the residents had been, and was able to track down Carmen Morano. I mean, a wonderful piece of detective work on the part of Rob Mercer. So he called Morano and talked to him about it. And I did the same thing. I called Morano and talked to him and got him on my radio program. So if you go to YouTube and look at a different perspective, Carmen Morano, you can listen to the interview, the hour-long interview I did with Carmen Morano about his experiences at Project Blue Book. And it may be one of the few times in this century that someone has been able to find an officer who served with Project Blue Book that was still alive and would talk about what was going on there. But the information that Mercer had found was not classified. It was all unclassified material. But there were things in that file that weren't in the official file. And so I could kind of marry the two files together to see where things went. But, you know, I mean, that kind of brings up the thing, you know, you've got to look. Who thought to be looking for UFO stuff on Craigslist, for crying out loud? but Mercer had heard it sometimes showed up, so he was looking for it, and he found it. He called the guy. The guy says, yeah, it's $100. And Mercer said, okay, and sent him the $100. And he got the box of UFO files, and it turned out to lead him to Morano, who said, well, I've got a lot of the other stuff. Do you want it too? And Mercer said, yeah. And he got a bunch of other boxes filled with UFO stuff. The one thing When Project Blue Book files were sent to the National Archives, before they went to the archives, the Air Force went through and redacted all the names of the witnesses, which kind of annoyed everybody. Bob Cornett and I had gone to Maxwell Air Force Base. We had learned that the Project Blue Book files were housed at Maxwell Air Force Base. We went down there and nothing had been redacted. And the first thing we did was we sat down and we went through the index and we wrote down all the unidentified cases and who the witnesses were. The photo cases, we did the same thing, physical evidence cases. So we had a list of the names. I think Don Berliner had a similar list. I'm not sure how he got it. He may have got it into the files when they got to the National Archives before the Air Force redacted it. And I think they redacted it because Jack Webb was doing a program called Project UFO, and he paid to have the files microfilmed so he could have a copy of it. I think the Air Force, as part of that, went through and redacted the names so the names would be gone. So Berliner had a copy of a lot of the names. Mercer's got a complete index with all the names in it. And that was part of the information that he got. I mean, a valuable document that he found because he was goofing around on Craigslist. I just astonished at the detective work that went into that he was able to get from Craigslist to Morano, who had all this other information that now is available to UFO researchers. And Mercer's very, very good about sharing the information with anybody who wants it. And I use a lot of that in the book, you know, to verify and validate the information that was in the Project Blue Book files and what some of the other people were telling me.
I love this. And boy, that's exciting. That's got to be crazy for you as a researcher and an author to be digging in and have this kind of information pop up. Because as we said, some of this you thought was just lost to time or never even knew existed. Was this one of the more and I don't want to use the term improperly, but one of the most unbelievable books and researches you had done with the amount of information that came out and then these strange synchronicities with even more information being found?
We call that the library fairy.
Okay.
And a great example of that, I was doing an action-adventure novel, and I was going to do something with the Battle of Khe Sanh, and I'm walking through a record store that's got a bunch of videotapes on it. For those of you who don't know, that you used to be able to buy videotapes with stuff on it. And
what's this you say? Videotapes?
Yeah. Think digital. Think DVD. But I was walking by, and there was a videotape staring me in the face of the Siege of Khe Sanh. And I'm thinking, this is great. So I bought the tape, and so I could see the base. I could describe the base accurately because I could see it on the videotape. So we call that the library fairy. You call it a synchronicity. It's all the same thing. So, yes, I would have never done this had I not been doing the radio program and talked to Ben Moss and Tony Angiola, who were talking about what they had found, and they made a couple of statements that I couldn't get a clear answer on, and it's not – I don't think they were dodging the question. I just, given the context of everything, we just didn't get around to that stuff as well as we could have. So I started to do some research about it, and the publisher for the book had sent me an email and said, "We understand you're doing a book about blah blah blah." And I said, "That book sold, but I'm doing this research into Sakura. Would you be interested?" And they said, "Yes, let us know." And I sent them, I think, three chapters, and they bought the book based on the three chapters. So I mean, so it all kind of lined up so that I could do the book and that sort of thing. So, but it's the information that I was able to blunder into, and the internet is the tool right there, the internet. I mean, you can type stuff in there and it leads you into all kinds of directions. You have to be able to filter the information because, contrary to what the lady said in the commercial, they can put stuff on the internet that's not true.
What?
Yeah, what? but so you have to filter it and you have to cross-check it and you have to make sure the sources. I do something on my blog, and I should mention that, the www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com, called Chasing Footnotes. And what has happened is a couple of things. And the story that got me on this was there was a story. I was looking for sightings of disc-shaped objects prior to Kenneth Arnold. And there was a story that came from the Cedar Rapids Gazette where a railroad engineer had seen 9 disc-shaped objects on the afternoon that Kenneth Arnold made the sighting. And it was in the Gazette prior to the Arnold story being broadcast. And I thought, this is great. And I went to a number of books and checked out the footnotes or the notes on it that led me to the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I went down to the local library and went through the Cedar Rapids Gazette for those days. Couldn't find that story. Was about to give up, and like on the 27th of June, 3 or 4 days after the Arnold sighting broke, there was a story about a Peoria engineer who had seen it, and that's the story. It was a engineer in Peoria, Illinois, who'd seen the disc-shaped object. It didn't appear prior to Arnold's sighting, which has made it useless to me. But it was in the Cedar Rapids Gazette. It was just some of the information had gotten garbled in the translation, I guess you would say. But I traced it from Dick Hall's book on UFO evidence to another book which used the source as Frank Edwards. Couldn't think of his name. Frank Edwards had given a speech in 1956 that mentioned this, and it gave the information from the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and I was able to get to the Cedar Rapids Gazette and get the information and straighten that whole thing out. So I do that, you know, try to, rather than say, okay, here's a footnote, that's good, let's see where the footnote takes us and if the information is accurately translated from the original source. So I try to get back to the original source. So I call it chasing footnotes. And it's just something when something I blunder into these things, I don't actively look for it. But when I do it, you know, I put something up on the blog about, you know, here's this story and here's what the original story is and here's where the information came from.
Absolutely fascinating. All right, with the book, it's out and available. I want people to remember that. Go rate it and review it on Amazon.com. talk to me as we're coming in through the end of the show here. You've got all this information. Come the end of it, do you believe that you have enough proof with this case that you could take this to a court of law and prove that there was definitely something unknown cited, something that fits the category of the paranormal or alien in nature?
If you're going into a court, yeah, I think we have the preponderance of the evidence to do that. But we need to prove it in the scientific arena, and that's a little bit more difficult. And where we run into it, you know, the Holder's report talking about the three additional witnesses would be valid in a court of law, because here's a document from the time we can source a document. It's clearly we have the chain of custody. We know everything we need to know about that document. But we can't name the witnesses. And I think that in a scientific arena, they say, well, that's interesting information, but it's lacking the names. We need the names of the people. I think if we go into a scientific arena, it's going to be a little bit more difficult because you have a higher level, a higher bar that you need to leap with the evidence there. In a court of law, I think we could go in there and we could say, yeah, this was something alien that landed there. In a scientific arena, I think they're going to look at it and say, this is interesting evidence. And there are multiple chains of evidence. You have not only Zamora sighting, but you have the physical evidence, the landing traces left behind, which is the pad imprints on the ground that clearly were pressed in the ground as opposed to excavated. You have the residue from the exhaust as the craft lift off that doesn't have any petrochemical in it, because that was analyzed. They could find nothing that would have set the bush on fire, or the grass is on fire, but they could see how one side of the bush was burned, the other side wasn't. It's kind of interesting the way that all worked out. So that is an interesting aberration to the sighting. You've got you know, the police officers on the scene, you've got the reaction of it, and you've got, you have to kind of look at the negative evidence as well, which is we can't find any terrestrial explanation for this. There was no experimentations going on at White Sands or Alamogordo that would explain it. The object resembles sort of the lunar lander, which they were testing at the time, but not in New Mexico, and they weren't flying independently. They were using helicopters to lift them and drop them and see how the craft reacted that way. So there was nothing going on in New Mexico like that. And had they been doing that in New Mexico, you know, Zamora said, "Well, here's what the thing looked like, but there's this big honking helicopter above it making all this noise, so we don't need to worry about that." So you know, I think you have to look at it from that point of view. In a court of law, I think we can prove the case. In the scientific arena, I think we can move to proving the case, but it's just not quite there. You know, it's just one or, you know, if somebody had photographed the damn thing in the sky at the time, and then we have the landing traces, or we had two or three people photographing the thing. In fact, I've said, you know, it's kind of a joke, well, with all the cameras and cell phones today, how come we don't have a sighting of a UFO taken from multiple locations, because everybody's walking around with a camera? And then I thought, yeah, but everybody's looking at their damn cell phone and not up in the sky. So it kind of rules that out. But I mean, if you had something like that, and if two people had taken photographs of the object as it lifted off from two separate locations, you'd have independently of one another, you'd have a marvelous case. So we're, you know, we're just lacking one of the chains of evidence that would help us to really take it into the extraterrestrial in the scientific arena.
Have you ever started to investigate one of these well-known sightings, one of these well-known encounters, and as you dig at it, it just completely falls apart into the deeper research?
Yeah. Yeah, the Charles Whitted sighting from, 1948, with the cigar-shaped craft with the square windows. You know, two airline pilots see the object coming at them. It flashes by. They both draw a cigar-shaped craft with square windows. The drawings don't look a whole lot alike, other than they're sort of cigar-shaped and they have square windows on it. And you're looking at that case, and one of the things was, well, the aircraft was rocked by turbulence as it flashed by. And you go back to the original statements the guys wrote, and there's nothing about turbulence in those statements. That comes out later. And then you have the Zond 4 reentry in March of 1968. And that's the Russian spacecraft that broke up and fell back to Earth. And a number of people thought they saw a cigar-shaped craft. and drew cigar-shaped craft with square windows. It looks an awful lot like the drawings that Charles Woodard had made. And then you're thinking, what if these guys had seen a bolide, a very bright meteor as it was breaking up? And then you go to YouTube, and what I found was something called Meteor Compilation. It's 3 minutes and 19 seconds of videos of meteor falls that have been videotaped. And you look at some of those, and you can see as the thing breaks up, it looks like you've got a bright cockpit and windows as the thing falls apart. And, of course, then the bits burn out and you lose sight of it. But for all the world, that looks an awful lot like the drawings of the Charles Woodard case. The Zond 4 reentry is well known in the UFO literature as being a point where many, many people were able to identify exactly what it was, but some people saw a cigar-shaped craft with square windows. So he put all that information together. He said, you know, Charles Woodard probably saw bolide. You know, back in 1948 when they made the sighting, we didn't know that much about bolides or meteor breakups or all that sort of thing. Although I think it might have been Hynek who wrote in the case file at one point early on, this sounds like a meteor. And everybody just ignored that. And I think that's a case that was one of the classics of UFO literature that I think is explained now by a bolide. So it kind of fell apart.
With this book, what were you really hoping that your listeners on your radio show and that the people reading this book are going to get from this new exploration of this 1964 case?
I think I would hope they look at it from a number of point of views. Number one, here's this information that is sort of inexplicable of a landing of some kind of vehicle. And what does that mean for us? But look at the way the book is structured, which isn't that exciting, but meaning looking at structures of books and things like that. But the way it is, I tried to footnote it to give the original sources. So it's not one of these sensational books where saying, oh, my God, we're being invaded. We got to do something now. Or one of these books says, oh, you all are full of crap. You're just hallucinating. You're not seeing these things. But look at it from the point of view. Here is the way to sort of attack the information of something that is very interesting and see what we can learn from this by doing the proper research into it, you know, footnoting the information, looking for the original sources as opposed to secondary sources. And too often in the UFO arena, we're looking at second and third hand sources. You know, one guy writes a book about UFOs and the next person writes a book using some of that information. And the first guy's made a mistake and that mistake is carried on and carried on and carried on. This book, I think, wipes away some of the mistakes that were made in the past. One of them being that, you know, Zamora is a standalone witness. No, there's other witnesses. There were other witnesses. They just weren't followed up. And kind of that idea of asking the questions, if I'm looking at that report in 1964, I'm going to try to find those other people.
Right.
Because it wouldn't have been that difficult to do, and it wouldn't be the first time I was knocking on doors. In fact, we were told, and I say we, Don Schmidt and I were told of pictures of the craft in Roswell that a rancher had taken. And all we had was the first name. And I went to the Chavez County assessor's office. Says, can you sort by first names? Because the guy had a strange first name. And they said, yeah. And there were three hits. And so we went, two of them were businesses, so that didn't count, like Standard Oil. But we went to the third one and we talked to the guy and there was nothing there. You know, we couldn't get to it. Another case I was told about is that there was a pilot who lived, I think, in Las Cruces. He had flown on Air Force One. He'd seen alien creatures and he'd taken John Kennedy to see the bodies from Roswell. I finally found the guy. It took me like, you know, 2 years to find him, but I finally found the guy. Yes, he had flown President Kennedy around in Air Force One. Yes, as an Air Force fighter pilot, he'd seen a craft off the wing of his fighter plane with a dome disc on it, and he could see the creature behind it. No, he had not flown Kennedy to see the Roswell bodies. All the elements were there, but when we got to the end of the story, it was, you know, basically a single witness UFO story which in and of itself was interesting. But if it had been President Kennedy had been taken to see the Roswell bodies, it would have been much better, especially if the guy had flown him there to do that. But it didn't work out that way. So, you know, there's cases where you follow up on it and it kind of blows up in your face, but you've got to follow the stories to the end. I mean, I could have reported that there's an Air Force pilot who, for Air Force One, who had flown John Kennedy to see the alien bodies. And that would have been true as far as I knew, because that's what I had been told. But when I chased down the information, I found out that the elements weren't quite what we had been told.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Encounter in the Desert, the case for alien contact at Socorro is out and available. We have a link up to that. If you visit with darknessradio.com, click on the Killer Deals link. You will find our Amazon page there. Or if you go to podcast1.com and click on the Killer Deals link and then scroll down to Beyond the Darkness, you'll find all of our links for our advertisers. You can follow our sponsors, and please do take advantage of those sponsors, because helping them helps us and helps the show. And remember that we want to hear from you. If you've had experiences with our advertisers, send me an email telling me your experience at dave@darknessradio.com. We want to thank our sponsor for today's episode. Amazon Prime exclusive series Lore is available right now. It's a great time to watch 6 compelling and chilling episodes. So go check that out. We will be back tomorrow with a look at Mark Twain and his supernatural fascination. This man was one of the most beloved authors and humorists on the planet, but his personal life was filled with darkness and very strange phenomena. You'll have to tune in tomorrow to find out more about that here on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slipcovers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange any time. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.